This is track two of lecture one of the series Inflation and Price Controls.
But if one wishes confirmation for what I have said about the domino effect of bank failures, one should think through the consequences if, say, the deposits of the Franklin National Bank had not been immediately taken over by another bank at the instigation and with the backing of the federal government. Think of what would happen if one of the large banks that was reported to be on the Federal Reserve's problem list failed and its deposits were wiped out. The consequence would surely be a massive wave of bank failures. Now, many economists who have recognized the inherent dangers of fiduciary media and who believe that there is no advantage to a country in a quantity of money that expands any more rapidly than gold and silver have come to the conclusion that the ideal monetary system would be the 100% metallic reserve system. Under this system, all paper currency and checking deposits would be 100% backed by gold or silver. The advantage of such a system would be that not only would it be immune from inflation, but unlike the fractional reserve gold standard of the 19th century and the first decades of this century, it would be immune from deflation as well. Because once gold or silver money comes into existence, it stays in existence. It is not wiped out by the failure of any debtor. Under such a system, financial failures do not become cumulative, self-reinforcing waves. Such a system would offer the maximum of monetary stability. Please note, the 100% reserve system is logically urged only for checking deposits and banknotes, not for savings deposits or time deposits. There is a crucial difference in that savings deposits and time deposits do not represent spendable money as such. When an individual makes a savings deposit or a time deposit, he temporarily gives up the use of his money. He cannot spend the savings or time deposit as such. If he wants his money, he must go and withdraw his deposit or wait until it matures. He must obtain actual money. When a bank lends the proceeds of a savings or time deposit, therefore, it is not engaged in the creation of money, but merely in the transfer of a given amount of money from a lender, that is, the savings or time depositor, to a borrower. Under the 100% reserve system, therefore, banks would continue to lend out savings and time deposits just as now. For the rest, they would earn money by charging fees for the storage of precious metal, its transfer from checking account to checking account, the issue of banknotes, and whatever other services they might perform. Now, the supporters of the 100% reserve principle divide into two groups. There are those who advocate its imposition by law. Those among this group who are committed to the principle of individual rights and laissez-faire capitalism try to justify this by claiming that the creation of fiduciary media is tantamount to counterfeiting and is fraudulent. They claim that it is the same in principle as accepting goods in a warehouse, issuing receipts for the goods, and then selling the goods, or selling more tickets to a theater performance than there are seats. Now, for my part, I believe that if the issuance of fiduciary media is conducted openly, without deception, that is, if it is no secret to the owners of banknotes and checking deposits that the backing for them is debt, one cannot outlaw the practice. Therefore, I join with the second group of supporters of the 100% reserve principle, the group which includes von Mises, in the advocacy of the policy known as free banking. That is, merely the total absence of all government intervention in banking. In von Mises' Human Action, there is a statement that he quotes and approves of, and with which I agree. It is from a 19th century French economist named Cernucci. It was made in reference to fiduciary media in the form of banknotes, but it applies equally to fiduciary media in the form of checking deposits as well. Sannucci said, quote, "I want to give everybody the right to issue banknotes so that nobody should take any banknotes any longer," unquote. In an economy that was free of government interference in money and banking, the creation of fiduciary media would be legal, but for practical purposes, it would not take place. The reason is that in a banking system totally unprotected and unsupported by the government, a banking system without any form of government controls, government inspections, or government examinations, a banking system without any form of government assurances, guarantees, or endorsements, in such a banking system, people would realize that when they made deposits in banks that did not hold a 100% reserve, they were, in fact, taking some risk of loss. They would realize that what they were doing was granting credit, not holding money, and that if they wanted to grant credit, they had better learn how to read a bank's balance sheet, how to evaluate it, and how to distinguish between good and bad banks. Those not prepared to do this, and whose real intention was to hold money, would realize that if that is what they wanted to do, they should hold deposits at 100% reserve banks. The transferable deposits of the fractional reserve banks would cease to be regarded as money. They would be regarded as credit instruments to be held only by those prepared to grant credit, not by people desiring to hold money. From the very beginning of our history, however, the government has sought to encourage the existence and growth of fiduciary media. The government has acted in the belief that the mere expansion of bank credit could create real capital goods and thus generate prosperity. All along, the government has been urged on and applauded by businessmen seeking lower rates of interest, seeking what they call easy money. What actually happened, of course, was not prosperity, but the trade cycle, as I have already indicated, and as you can study further on your own, in von Mises' Human Action, and in a book called The Organization of Debt into Currency by a brilliant 19th century economist named Charles Holt Carroll. I will not describe the ways in which the government promoted fiduciary media in the 19th century, except to note that it did all it could to encourage confidence in them and several times saved the banks issuing them from collapse. I will limit myself to describing how it has given increased encouragement to their creation in this century. In this century, the government has encouraged the expansion of fiduciary media principally through the Federal Reserve System, which was established in 1913. The Federal Reserve System has supplied the banking system with vastly more reserves in the form of Federal Reserve notes and deposit credits than it could possibly have acquired if its reserves had had to be in gold, as was the case before World War I. The more rapid growth in reserves has been a necessary foundation for the more rapid growth in checking deposits, because the deposits banks can create are always tied to the amount of reserves at their disposal. Banks require reserves in relation to their deposits as a safety precaution. In addition, the Federal Reserve System has made it possible for any given volume of reserves to support a larger volume of deposits. It has done this by virtue of following one of the avowed objectives of its foundation, which was to act as a lender of last resort to the commercial banks. The Federal Reserve System stands ready to lend standard money to the banks or buy assets from them whenever they require. This permits the banks to hold such assets as the Federal Reserve will buy or lend money on in place of holding actual reserves. The result is an expansion of deposits because when the banks acquire these assets, the sellers usually take the proceeds of their sale and bring them back to the banking system in the form of fresh deposits. The result is that the banks have the same reserves supporting more deposits. Finally, the government has further promoted the existence of fiduciary media in this century through such measures as the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, increased governmental supervision of banks, and increased control over the nature of the loans and investments banks can make. All of these measures promote confidence in fiduciary media by virtue of the government's word rather than by virtue of the fact of financial soundness. If not for these and other such measures, banks would have to hold far larger reserves in relation to checking deposits to instill the same degree of confidence. In all of these ways, therefore, some of them going back to the early 19th century, and in other ways that I have not mentioned, the government has been responsible for the creation of fiduciary media. It, therefore, must bear full responsibility for the boom-bust pattern of our economic history, and, of course, for the rapid increase in the quantity of money that has taken place in our time. Today, by virtue of the government's unlimited ability to create standard money and to supply it to banks in need of it, and by virtue of its commitments to do so, fiduciary media can be considered virtually as standard money created by the government itself, that is, as part of the overall supply of fiat money. Now that we have a good idea of the nature and importance of fiduciary media in the money supply, it will pay us to take a look at the actual statistics of the money supply. I have provided you with the figures for the size of the money supply in various years from 1929 to the present. You have the figures before you in the handout you received. They appear in Table 1. The figures are for the sum of currency in circulation plus the checking deposits held at the commercial banks. All standard money other than currency in circulation is regarded as counted in the checking deposits of the commercial banks and thus does not explicitly appear. In the official statistics and in the financial press, this statistic is described as M1. The figures show a steady and dramatic increase in the money supply since 1933. Incidentally, if you wish to follow the future growth in the money supply on your own, you can do so in the financial section of the New York Times every Friday. Since the New Deal took office in 1933, the money supply has increased approximately 15-fold, or at a compound rate of 6.3% per year. Even if one wishes to compute the increase in the money supply on a far more conservative basis, say in comparison with its pre-New Deal peak year of 1929, the overall increase is still in excess of 11-fold, or at a compound rate of about 5.4% per year. These figures, of course, include the massive increase in the money supply used in the financing of World War II. Nevertheless, observe how since 1955, the rate of increase for each five-year period has increased, despite the absence of any major war. From 1955 to 1960, the money supply increased by $6.4 billion on a base of $138.2 billion. From 1960 to 1965, it increased by $22.8 billion on a base of $144.6 billion. From 1965 to 1970, it increased by $47.2 billion on a base of $167.4 billion. And from 1970 to 1975, it increased by $80.4 billion on a base of $214.6 billion. The last 20 years clearly show an accelerating rate of increase in the money supply. The compound annual rate for the last 5 years has reached a level well in excess of 6%. The rapid rate of increase in the quantity of money since 1933 is what has made this period of our history one of rising prices. It is the cause of the rise in prices. Now, we have seen that government control over the quantity of money is the only thing that can account for such rapid rates of increase in its quantity. The entire problem of inflation stems from the government's ability to increase the money supply more rapidly than the increase in gold and silver. From the point of view both of summarizing our knowledge of inflation and of indicating the appropriate action to take to stop it, it follows from our discussion tonight that it would be logical to define inflation as an increase in the quantity of money caused by the government. An increase in the quantity of money caused by the government. That is, as a virtual equivalent, as an increase in the quantity of money in excess of the rate at which a gold and silver money would increase. It is this which produces all of the symptoms people associate with inflation. It is this which has to be stopped in order to stop those symptoms. It can be stopped by the establishment of a full-fledged gold and silver standard and the cessation of all further government interference with money. The definition I propose conveys all of this information. Now, of course, as I pointed out in my introduction to the subject of inflation, the knowledge that it is a product of government control over the quantity of money is unpalatable to today's intellectuals, and they have done everything possible to obscure it. Next week, we will begin to consider all of the alternative explanations of rising prices the opponents of the quantity theory offer. We will see how each of these explanations is either totally false or must be interpreted as giving further confirmation to the quantity theory of money. Thank you. All right, if you're ready, I'm ready. I have several written questions here. One is, if the money supply increases at the same rate as production, won't the price level remain constant? Isn't that possible without a gold standard? What would be wrong with that? Well, it is true that if the money supply and production increased at the same rate, the price level would tend to remain constant. But now, is that possible without a gold standard? I would say, in fact, no. Now, you can imagine any given rate of increase in the money supply you wish, in paper or any other substance. But the reason, if we have a paper money, that the money supply will increase more and more rapidly, is because, first of all, there is no intrinsic limit on the increase. You can create paper money simply by printing it, and it is costless. The only kind of obstacle is the government's self-restraint. The government has the power. They also have the motivation. The government has the motive of making it appear that there are free benefits. It can always appear that a larger quantity of money would be useful to meet this or that crisis. There are all kinds of motives for the government to increase the money supply. Now, not only do they have the motive, but the majority of the people in the government deny that there is even any connection. As they claim matters exist, there is no connection between the quantity of money and demand or the price level. They are critics of the quantity theory of money. So you would be asking people who have the motive to expand the money supply and who either do not know or are choosing not to know what the consequences of it are, you would be expecting that they would limit themselves. Now, in fact, they would not limit themselves. What you are really depending on, this is a wider issue, really. When you give the government the power to create money, you are placing all of your life savings, every contract that you have that is denoted in terms of dollars, you are placing that at the mercy of the government officials. They have the power to create money. They can do it as much as they wish. What you are counting on is, A, that they have knowledge of the quantity theory of money, which they, for the most part, do not have. B, you'd be counting on their having integrity, so that if they do have the knowledge, they will act on the basis of that knowledge. And you'd be counting on them having rationality, so that they would expect that in a particular situation they could not be saved by a miracle. Well, if that is what you're counting on, I would say that you have a very slender basis. And to make this wider, the real implications of this are everyone who has money in a savings account, in bonds, in a pension fund whose assets are invested in fixed securities, your life savings are at the mercy of the knowledge, the integrity, and the rationality of Edward Kennedy and his associates. And that is a condition in which I would not like to be. Now, the question is, could the Federal Reserve at this time follow a policy of zero growth of the money supply without creating a major recession or depression? I would say, no, it could not, meaning if the Federal Reserve stopped the growth in the money supply short, as of now, they would create a major recession or depression, and the very fact that they have tried to slow it down in the last year and a half has created a major recession. But this is a matter that we'll go into more fully in Lecture 3 when we understand how increases in the money supply come to require further increases. Do I have any questions, oral questions? Yes? Would a debt moratorium help the city? Well, I really don't know how to answer that. It would make things easier for the politicians in the city. It could also make things easier for many of the taxpayers, but obviously it would be very bad for whoever holds the bonds. Now, I wouldn't be prepared to answer whether I think the city should file for bankruptcy or not. I really have not thought enough about that issue. Now, someone asks a question. You have given a mathematical definition of the price level. P equals demand, price level equals demand divided by supply. I do not see how this tells us what determines the price level or why necessarily everything that affects the price level must work through these factors. Is not another definition of the price level possible? Why are demand and supply the only possible proximate causes? Well, simply by virtue of the nature of what a price is and the price level is, let's take the price of an individual good. What does the average price of a pair of shoes over a period of time equal? The average price at which shoes are sold in Florsheim's shoe store down 42nd Street is necessarily equal to the amount of money spent to buy those shoes divided by the quantity of those shoes sold. So this is mathematically inescapable. If we mean by the price level the prices at which goods are in fact bought and sold, I don't see how you can avoid the relation between demand and supply. This is what I mean by the price level. Yes? Yeah. Fiduciary media are transferable claims to standard money payable on demand by the issuer and accepted in commerce as the equivalent of standard money, but for which no standard money actually exists. I think that does it. I can look back into the text if I have to. Can you compare the increase in the quantity of gold since 1929 with the quantity of money? I do not know the exact figure for the increase in gold since 1929, but it is a very small fraction of the increase in the quantity of paper. Gold may increase on the order of 1% a year, 2% a year. Paper, as I pointed out, has increased since 1933 at more than 6% a year, and we're just first beginning to experience how fast paper can increase. In Argentina, it can increase 50 or 100% a year. This gentleman straight back here. All right, why do I say that the government is responsible for increasing the quantity of money to a point large enough, or let me put it this way, why do I say that increases in demand on a scale great enough to raise prices are the result of the action of the government? Well, if we had a gold standard, the quantity of money would increase and demand would increase, but the increase would almost never be sufficient to raise prices, because gold and silver would only increase as part of production. They could only increase as the general ability to produce increased. What you have to do to increase the quantity of money and demand more rapidly than production is to make the monetary unit something that is not produced, the paper of the government. Array my point 3G. Am I saying that deflation necessarily causes depression and poverty? Why? I would say that deflation necessarily does cause a depression and poverty for very large numbers of people, simply because it puts them in the position of having to go bankrupt. If you have deflation, a decrease in the quantity of money, the money revenues and the money incomes of individuals must fall. That is what the quantity theory of money tells us. Well, if people's money revenues and money incomes are falling, how are they to be able to meet their debts? They have to go bankrupt. It would be possible, with a big enough deflation, that everybody in the United States who owed any debt at all could simultaneously be bankrupt, simply because your debts are fixed. You owe what you owe, that is given. Your ability to service that debt depends on the money that you make. And the money that you make depends primarily on the quantity of money that exists. So if you have less money, you have less money income and money revenue, less ability to pay debts. So everyone who owes money would be in a more difficult position. Yes? The Federal Reserve is an agency of the United States government. The fiction exists that it is owned by the private banks, because the banks have to contribute some sum of money on which they are paid a dividend. But in reality, the Federal Reserve System is a branch of the government. The Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System are all of them appointed by the President and confirmed by the Senate. So it's a total fiction to think of it as a private institution. Now, question, what is magical about gold or silver as a standard as opposed to GNP for issuance of medium of exchange? Well, there's nothing magical about gold or silver. Gold and silver are commodities which can be increased only very slowly and moderately. These are commodities which large numbers of private individuals have chosen to own over the course of history as a store of savings that has fitted them to be used as money. So this is the free choice of the market. Now, you could not use such a thing as gross national product as a basis of the quantity of money, because first one would have to ask, what do you mean by gross national product? The monetary gross national product? Well, the gross national product in terms of money gets bigger and bigger the more money we have. The Italians have a much bigger gross national product in lira than we have in dollars, because there are more lira than dollars. Now, if you want to say, well, can't we issue money in proportion to the increase in production? Well, in my formula for the price level, I assumed a precision in thought which we would have a difficult time applying in practice. See, we can say, let us assume that supply doubles. Now, it is valid, we know that supply increases or decreases. There's no question that the total supply of the United States today is vastly larger than 100 years ago, vastly larger than that of Great Britain, larger than it was 5 years ago. So the concept of increases in supply, decreases in supply is valid. The concept of larger or smaller increases is valid. If you ask me, however, go out and show me, has supply increased this year 2.6% or 3.1%? Well, I don't think we could pin it down that precisely in practice. We could have an area of dispute. We could say, well, has supply increased or decreased? Has it increased or decreased by a lot or a little? But we would not be able to say just how much precisely, because we would have some problems. First of all, how do we evaluate qualitative changes? I think it's legitimate to say that because we have the automobile in place of the horse and buggy, that gives us a much bigger supply of means of transportation. But how much bigger exactly would we count one automobile versus one horse and buggy? We couldn't arrive at the exact precision in measurement. Now, this has bearing on the statistics that you hear about increases or decreases in the price level. Actually, we could not say in any given year if the price level has really increased by 6% or 5.8%. We can say, really, the price level has increased noticeably or imperceptibly or more strongly or less strongly. But I think it's a mistake to give too much credence to too high a degree of precision of the actual measurements of these things. I had thought that the unions constantly raising wages and their demands for higher pensions and more benefits was instrumental in causing inflation. Is that not part of it? Well, that question will be dealt with thoroughly next week in the course of the lecture. Yes?
If I recall, you said that there's been an increase of $80 billion in the last 5 years in the money supply. If I understand right, we're going to have another $84 billion in the deficit. Is that a total increase in the money supply?
No, the question is, does the deficit of the federal government represent an increase in the money supply? It would be very rare that you would ever find the entire deficit financed by an increase in the money supply. What happens, however, is when the federal government operates at a deficit, it will finance some of the deficit by an increase in the money supply. They don't have to finance all of it by an increase in the money supply, because as they expand the quantity of money, people's money incomes and money revenues go up, and the federal government is automatically expanding its own tax collections as a result of the rise in people's money incomes. So there's a definite connection between deficits and creation of the money, of the money supply, but it is not a dollar-for-dollar connection. The question here says, quote, "You've said that increases in supply cause deflation and therefore depression and poverty. Could you amplify the relationship between deflation and depression and poverty?" No, I did not say that increases in supply cause deflation and therefore depression. I criticized that view. What I did say was that if one defines, or if one calls rising prices due to less supply, if one calls that inflation, then one has to say that lower prices due to more supply are deflation. That is a reason for not calling rising prices due to less supply inflation. Because obviously more supply is not the cause of depression or poverty. As for the rest of the question, could I amplify the relationship between deflation and depression and poverty? I think I covered that. Deflation itself puts all debtors in a more difficult position to repay their debts. If it's a big enough deflation, the debtors have to go broke. This gentleman here.
Why are we then considering
Right. Savings accounts, you say, have no limitation. Have no limitation on the amount of money that you can withdraw or how frequently you can withdraw it. The reason I don't include them in the money supply is because first you have to withdraw. First you have to go and get the money. At that point you no longer have the deposit. So you cannot, what you cannot do is take your savings passbook and spend the passbook. You cannot go into a store and say, here is my savings passbook, let me have these goods. But with a checking account, you have a checking deposit, you can go into a store and say, here is a check, let me have these goods. No, when you put money in a savings account, the bank lends the money. That's true. But you are not able to spend that money, so what has happened is you have transferred part of the money you have earned to someone to whom the bank makes a loan. See, that is very different than with a checking account. In the savings account, you give up your power to spend, the bank lends the money, someone else has the power to spend. In the checking account situation, you make a deposit, you retain the power to spend by writing checks, and someone else gets a loan. Yes? Pardon? Who first formulated the quantity theory of money? I'm sorry to say that I cannot tell you the man's name. I've seen references to Italian economists in the 16th century. Supposedly, in one of the plays by Aristophanes, there is some reference to the quantity theory of money. The quantity theory of money was well known by the mid-18th century, certainly. And perhaps I should know who the originator was, but I don't. Yes?
With an appeal of the legal tender law, the
Would the repeal of the legal tender law be tantamount to instituting the gold standard? No, I don't think so, but I'm sorry to give you just such a short answer. I'd have to raise so many issues that would take a very long time. Yes, the young lady in the far back. Oh, simply that at any time there is so much that is spent in the course of a year and there is so much that is sold in exchange for that money. For example, last year in the United States, so many billion dollars were spent to buy all of the various consumer goods, and those consumer goods consisted of so many houses, so many pairs of shoes, etc. Yes, sir? All right. I didn't give, the question is, would I please explain what causes booms and busts, or what has caused them in our history? I did not by any means give a full explanation. All I indicated was that a very critical role is played by the expansion of fiduciary media, of debt money, and by its subsequent contraction. In the course of the boom, fiduciary media are expanded. This raises people's money revenues, money incomes. It makes it appear that they are prosperous. Then, for reasons connected with the issuance of fiduciary media themselves, widespread business failures take place. Banks which have lent this money find that a significant part of their assets are wiped out. Some of these banks fail. Then we have a deflation. But I would have to refer you on this point further to von Mises' Human Action and to Charles Holt Carroll, the organization of debt into currency. The gentleman back here. All right, the question is, if the money supply doubles, will the price of gold also double? Well, there can be no fixed formula. See, obviously, the money supply has doubled and redoubled several times since 1933, yet the price of gold did not rise until about 1968. If the money supply were to double again within the next few years, the price of gold might not only double, perhaps it would quadruple or go even further. It depends how sustained and how long range the increase in the money supply is and how it is perceived by people. If it is perceived by people as being a temporary aberration or they're not aware of it, they're not used to its consequences, then it might have little effect. But again, I think we would have to wait. Perhaps you might want to raise this question after lecture 3, when we have some knowledge of how increases in the quantity of money affect the desire of people to own money. And that would relate to whether they would want paper or gold. The gentleman over there.
On a complete gold standard, is there enough currency for every person who chooses to be productive to make the transaction necessary?
All right, this is a very good question. If we had a full gold standard, a 100% gold standard or something close to it, is there enough gold to finance trade? That is the question. Yes, there is. There is always enough money to finance trade. It doesn't depend on the physical quantity of money. It depends on the physical quantity of money in relation to the prices of goods. Now, we could have the same quantity of money, and it could finance twice or five or 10 times the physical volume of trade if prices were half of what they are, or a fifth of what they are, or a tenth of what they are. You see, suppose you ask yourself the question, how many eggs does a dollar buy? There is no intrinsic answer to that question. It depends on the price of eggs. Now, this incidentally has application to a major principle of sound economics known as Say's Law, S-A-Y, apostrophe S. Say was a 19th century French economist. Say's Law declared that real demand, what the money demand can actually buy, is determined by supply. All you need is more supply. More supply lowers prices. That creates more purchasing power for the same money. So we are really not dependent on the quantity of money having to grow at some definite rate. If the supply of gold grew less than the supply of other goods, we still have enough gold. Yes? Not at all. If we had years in which the increase in the supply of gold and silver did not keep pace with the increase in the supply of other goods, we would have a falling price level. Now, we had a falling price level for over half of the 19th century, in the generation before 1848 and in the generation following 1873. So we could have a successful economy with falling prices resulting from additional production. And that, I stress, would not be deflation. That would be simply greater prosperity. Yes? That an investment banking firm handled any given amount of security? I don't know what point of view you're asking it from. If you're asking it from the point of view, is this an unexpectedly large amount, I couldn't even say because I don't know what they normally handle. What would certainly cause me surprise is if you told me that someone had to pay $300 for lunch, which might happen sometime. Then we'll know that we have problems. Yes? You ask, what would be wrong with steadily increasing prices if it weren't for the discontent? Well, now you'd have to ask, what is the connection between the steadily increasing prices and the discontent? And that is what is wrong. Because, you see, the increasing prices resulting from the increase in the quantity of money are benefiting some people arbitrarily at the expense of other people. They disrupt credit and debtor relationships. They are causing widespread losses to many people. And that is why they create discontent. Yes?
What is the definition of standard money?
Standard money would be the money which has ultimate debt-paying power, which is not redeemable in terms of anything else. So today, the currency issued by the Federal Reserve, the deposit liabilities of the Federal Reserve, the token coins, these are standard money. On a gold standard, the standard money is the gold coin, because that is what all other money or debt is ultimately payable in. Yes? Would falling prices resulting from increased supply hurt debtors? No, it would not. Let us imagine that over some period of time, supply doubled. Now, if you were a debtor who had increased your supply by double, along with the average increase, then you would be able to earn the same amount of money at half the prices that you had initially earned. You would have twice the goods to sell at half the prices. Pardon me? How would you be able to manufacture twice the goods? Well, the ability to produce does not depend on the quantity of money. The ability to produce depends on such factors as scientific and technological progress, the proportion of the economy's existing output that is devoted to producing machinery, factory buildings, and so forth. So you get a growing ability to produce if an economy has scientific and technological progress, if it devotes a sufficient proportion of its effort to producing capital goods, and I should also add, importantly, if it uses its existing capital goods efficiently. The quantity of money has little or nothing to do with this, except that a too rapid increase in the quantity of money can slow the process down. See, more money does not mean more wealth. If more money meant more wealth, there would be no poverty in the world. Each country would only need a printing press. They could have all the money they wanted. But you do not create wealth by creating money. You create wealth through science and technology, savings and investment, the efficiency of production. Yes?
What definition of money supply would you recommend one to follow wishes to focus on the rate, the day-to-day change or rate of inflation?
All right, the question is, what monetary statistic would I recommend if you are interested in following the changes? Well, the one that is most readily available is what I refer to as M1, which is simply the sum of currency in circulation plus checking deposits. Now, I would caution really against attaching much significance to week-by-week fluctuations, because the money supply in any given week can go up or down by a couple of $1 billion and it doesn't tell you anything. What you should look at is changes over longer periods of time. The gentleman far back there. All right, the question is, I say that the government has no limit to its ability to increase the money supply. Could it be argued that public opinion could constitutes a limit, or could constitute a limit? Well, in order for public opinion to constitute a limit, first the public would have to know, understand, and accept the quantity theory of money. At present, none of this is true, so public opinion is not in a position to limit the increase in the quantity of money. If public opinion really wanted to limit the increase, then public opinion would advocate a gold standard. Now, I think we can take perhaps just one or two more questions. Let me try to get someone who has not yet asked the question. The gentleman right here. Please speak louder. Have I thought of a step-by-step procedure by which we might be able to move toward a gold standard? There would be a variety of ways, I would think, but the one most crucial way is simply for the government not to place obstacles in the path of a large number of people owning gold. If we reach the point where gold comes to be widely owned, that can lead to the creation of a gold standard, whether the government wants to introduce it or not. Simply because if you have a large number of people owning gold and wanting to acquire more of it, that creates the condition in which people can begin to exchange goods against gold. And that's all you need to make gold money. One final question. Mr. Professor Buechner?
What is your view of the constitutional amendment that the halfway point would limit the percentage rate of increase in the money supply for you?
What would be my view of a constitutional amendment specifying the rate of increase in the money supply? I would think that that would be a very wasted effort. If you are going to change the Constitution and go to all of that trouble, then why not fight a fundamental battle and establish the gold standard? And you see, such a constitutional amendment could always be changed. There's no reason for picking one percentage rather than another percentage. If you want to limit the quantity of money, the real procedure is to have a gold standard. That is a more effective limitation than anything you could write in the Constitution, because then you are limiting the quantity of money by a physical fact, namely, the government cannot create gold. All right, I think we have to draw a line here. I'd be glad to take your question next week if you come back. Okay, thank you.